غسان كنفاني in his novella Return to Haifa has this Palestinian mother and father, Safiya and Saeed, drive back to Haifa from Lebanon. In the novella, you know, Israel opens its border for an instance, and they quickly drive back to try and find their child, which was kidnapped in 1948 and during the Nakba. And on the route there, Saeed is silent, and you know, Safiya is like, you know, what's going on? I thought you wanted to do this. And I don't remember kind of the exact conversation, but at one point, you know, Saeed bursts out and says, I'm not seeing it. They're showing it to me. I'm not seeing Palestine. They're showing it to me. And I think this is, again, kind of to return to this idea of an image as a wall, is exactly in that, in the sense that Saeed at that moment refused to return to Palestine as a visitor, refused to return to Palestine as an image. And I think this is where, as Palestinians, it's so tricky, because when we become filmmakers in this late capitalist order, we are kind of rendered into individuals that are expressing themselves in the diaspora. And I think we really need to, and I think a lot of us are doing that, we need to position ourselves, one, as a collective, and therefore collectivize our process of making films. Two, I think we need to reject this nostalgic urge to return to Palestine as an image, and really kind of think about how images themselves have been weaponized against us, and how can we recapture those images? How can we even kind of operate from the from that ownership, from our indigenous stewardship to these images, which are kind of like this. They're kind of an image-based extension of the land, right? And so how can we return to them on that basis, both as kind of a struggle and contradiction with these images as modes of erasing us, but also at the same time, those images as an extension of our land?
Razan Al-Salah is a Palestinian filmmaker, artist, and teacher whose work moves through militant cinema and collective filmmaking practices, as well as archives and digital infrastructures. She approaches the image not as a transparent evidence, but as a contested terrain, a site where histories are produced, obscured, weaponized, and reclaimed. Her films often inhabit the unstable space between visibility and disappearance, asking how one might return to places rendered inaccessible, and how images can both reinforce and resist colonial borders and ways of seeing. Drawing from anti-colonial cinema, found footage, oral histories, and fragmented archives, Razan Al-Salah develops a practice attentive to the political life of images and the material conditions of their circulation. Her work reflects on the excessive image production surrounding Palestine, the normalization of violence through repetition, and the infrastructures, whether technological, military, and ideological. They shape what can be seen and remembered. Against this, she proposes other modes of creative encounter, collective processes of filmmaking, and resistance forms of distribution rooted in relation, opacity, and solidarity. In this podcast, Razan Al-Salah reflects on the role of artistic imagination in contexts of ongoing catastrophe and on cinema as a site of gathering, resistance, and rehearsed return. We talk about archives as both evidence and border, the camera as a mediating and potentially violent device, and the ways images are mobilized for population control and self-fulfilling colonial narratives. We also discuss solidarity, censorship, and the need to redirect attention toward images produced by resistance movements themselves, not simply as documents of suffering, but as tools for reclaiming historical and political agency.
I think, you know, I prefer the word exile versus diaspora because it reminds us that our separation from the land and our home was a severance, and that we are rehearsing a return as a way to recall that severance and to radicalize the possibilities of how do we return? Do we return as visitors? Do we return as tourists? Because these could be possibilities, especially for those who are exiled in the global north, right? And so I think this is where I try to grapple with this in my films, and I try to make sure that they're not narrative traps. And of course, it's always a tension, right? Because it is emotional. And there is an emotional aspect to the film, but I think that is always tethered to the making of the film as a different way of looking at images. And so how do you hold those two things where you're, again, like, your survival is attached to an imaginary, but also the imaginary is attached to survival, or hope is rooted in resistance rather than it just being a hope to return to Palestine as this nostalgic idea. So yes, I mean, I start from my own family histories, but I always think of them as collective conditions. And I try, even in the in my latest film, A Stone's Throw, a 40-minute experimental documentary that I make with my father, Amin Salah. As a main subject, you don't really know that he's my father throughout the film. And, you know, he is one person that is being interviewed, but at the same time, so many elements that are weaved into the film also collectivize his material labor conditions and also historicize his labor conditions in ways that connect him and connect a lot of the Palestinians in exile that work in offshore oil fields with the oil laborers of Haifa in 1936 and their contribution to the 1936-1939 revolt. And so again, in this historicization, you're collectivizing, you're making sure that it's not about Amin as an individual or my relationship to my father, although that is often the beginning, the start. And it gives the process its groundedness. But I always think about like how can then the film understand these family conditions, the conditions of his life as those shared by many Palestinians, also many laborers today from the global south, from South Asia, from the Arab world, but also collectivize it in and through the Palestinian struggle by a kind of this retro future of the possibility of blowing up oil pipelines to refuse not just divest your labor, but refuse a colonial project, because you understand that what you're building is actually the infrastructure of the occupation that is coming soon in 1936, today. I mean, we can see how this is happening today. A lot of people are talking about these oil infrastructures that are being destroyed in the Gulf as a way to release the region, and how destroying these oil infrastructures might open up the material possibility for these monarchies to fall. And can we imagine a different Arab world where like the Gulf is governed by its own people and people who consider themselves part and parcel of the liberation of the region from Western hegemony, and the liberation of Palestine from Zionist occupation? Like, can we imagine? A Stone's Throw started during the pandemic when my brother Lutfi and I decided to have conversations with Amin, our dad, about his work on Zirku Island. For us, up until then, it was called The Island. So it had this kind of aura around it because we did not know anything about what our dad was doing there. We knew that he went to work there 40 years of his life, 40 days at a time, 20 days back in Beirut where we grew up. He would go back and forth, and we didn't even know that actually there were no breaks. Like, they were 40 days straight, 12-hour shifts. pretty brutal outdoor work conditions, and so in the desert. So we started having these conversations, and slowly and surely I was like, Baba, I think, you know, this is becoming a film. And of course I was recording the conversations already. And he was like, oh, you know, don't bother. You can't really enter the island with a camera, so you can't really make a film. And I'm like, Shuya Baba, you haven't seen any of my films? You haven't watched any of my films? I'm like the expert of making films that where cameras cannot go, where I can't go, right? And so this is where like the primary mission became, how do we reappear the disappeared laborers, landscapes, conditions, life on Zirko Island, starting with Amin, but also thinking about it as a land, as a man camp, as an infrastructure that extends also from a certain history. And so this is where the research, you know, first of all, we kind of plunged into Google Earth together. And so we were having these conversations on Zoom with our dad, and we started so Zoom was mediating our conversation, or like a video calling application was mediating our conversation. But then we started sharing our screen, and we started kind of navigating the Google Earth satellite capture of the island together as well, and navigating the island. And, you know, Amin telling me, like, this is the control room, this is where I used to work, this is the workshop, this is where I threw myself in the water every single day after a 12-hour shift to take a break and kind of return to my body in a different way, you know, and release. And we talked about all kinds of details that are not in the film. It's funny that I know so much about the island now through these conversations. And then I was thinking, okay, what are other ways that we could visualize the island? And, you know, I'm very much attached to found images. And so, because, you know, there's a sanctity that is lost to the image, I think, and we produce so many images. And in that excess, I'm kind of trying to counter that excess with great attention to what has already been made. And so I looked at a nature preservation documentary that was produced by Zatko, the oil company itself. And I realized that there's a whole genre of films that belong to the greenwashing machine of oil companies. And so to every oil company, there's a nature preservation project. And to every nature preservation project, there's a propaganda film about how the oil company is protecting and enhancing the nature around its extraction sites. So that was one kind of piece of found material that's in the film. And another piece of found material is a safety video around the safety measures that laborers should take when handling what they call dirty oil, which is oil that has hydrogen sulfide in it that could seep into the air and actually suffocate and kill anyone who breathes it in. And I realized that they produced that safety video after three laborers died in that way. And for me, again, even a safety video, which is considered kind of a technicality or a necessary technicality, becomes political, because it really burdens the timing of that and the form of that animation, as you see in the film, burdens the laborer with their own death, right? And really, actually, you could see that, like, the kind of this boss angel that comes onto the laborer that has, not followed instructions and warns him again, you know? Like, you haven't followed instructions, and that's why you're in the hospital. At the same time, one of the most kind of sensitive conversations I've had with Amin was him, like, admitting that his first year on the island got him hospitalized for depression. I kind of take that story and counterpoint it with that animation and kind of think about mental health also as safety, but also thinking about how that also was buried. His depression was also buried, disappeared, is disappeared by the safety video, is not, yeah. Another part of the research took me to understanding what does that, those labor conditions, what do they have to do with Amin being a Palestinian refugee? And I realized that his ancestors, the Haifa laborers who built the Kirkuk-Haifa pipeline for British Petroleum in 1936, decided to lay down their hammers and take up their guns because they decided to sabotage the pipeline at different points of the kind of different points on the pipeline and different towns and villages across Palestine because they realized that the British actually were training Zionist gangs to protect that pipeline. And the pipeline eventually will become, its protection is part of the of laying the military infrastructure of the settler colony to be. Also, the pipeline itself was part of that infrastructure. And so they realized that and they didn't just stop building it, but they decided to sabotage it. And the revolt at large decided to sabotage it. So there was that history that I think was necessary to kind of be connected as also a possibility for our region today. And this is, you know, why I said, like, can we imagine? Like, can we imagine these infrastructures and blowing them up? What would that do? To the possibility of a completely different infrastructure, political infrastructure, emerging in the in different parts of the region, and I remember kind of making a cut that only included found images, all of these found images, with the interview with Amin and showing the cut to Amin, speaking of an embedded audience. And Amin going like, I'm sorry, Razan, but I don't understand anything, you know? Like, what are you, what is this film about? And I was like, it was funny and I was like taken aback and I really went back and thought through, like, why is this film illegible to the person who's speaking in it? And this is where I realized that actually, one, we need to see Amin, that his body is also a landscape, that Beirut is a landscape, that that I could also take a camera and trespass the border through a zoom lens simply by going to the south of Lebanon and filming the south and filming Palestine from the south. And so I think it was the first time that I decided to pick up a camera and in my practice, instead of working with only found images. And I'm, you know, as I mentioned, I'm very careful with that because of the weaponization of images, because cameras have often been kind of operated like weapons, like guns. And, you know, against the people that they've shot, literally. I think that was the moment where, and, you know, I picked up a Bolex 100-foot real manual camera also to set a limitation on the amount of images that I can take at once. You know, every crank is around 30 seconds, 100 feet is 2 minutes and a half, and then you have to reload the entire magazine. So I set also like my own limitations. I almost wish I filmed more because these border villages today are being detonated and pulverized by the Israeli death machine. I think these images that I took are so precious. And yeah, I think that's everything in the film, plus phytograms of seaweed that I collected along the coast from Beirut all the way to Naoura. I even like went to visit my nephew on the west coast of Turtle Island and collected seaweed there, and also included it as a phytogram to include my nephew also in the process, the youngest member of our family. And to kind of like the seaweed and the sea and how it trespasses the border, but also the temporalization of Palestine as past and present and future, because, you know, what Amin remembers from Haifa and that archival image of the laborers of the pipeline all happens around, in and around the sea, and Beirut and his kind of walk on the seacoast. It's all kind of, the sea kind of becomes a way through which the film flows, and all of these landscapes are weaved together or float together in the same sea, in the same scape. And but also like actually, you know, the sea is very much kind of the way that like grounds you and situates you in a city like Beirut, and I'm sure in a city like Haifa. And, you know, in my dad's memory of it, I always think that, you know, when I'm looking at the horizon from Beirut, I'm kind of quantum traveling into the horizon that Amin was looking at as a 3-year-old in Haifa. Yeah. One of the concluding statements of the film Resistance Why, when Ghassan Kanafani is speaking to what the resistance offered its people, and he says they did not offer better housing conditions or water or food, they offered hope of returning, of hope of a dignified life. And I think this is where this question on the role of the intellectual starts. Hope needs to be rooted in resistance. The imaginary needs to be kind of in a productive contradiction with survival, so that the imaginary is not abstracted and extractive, and so that survival is not technocratic and bureaucratic. So I think in that tension, the role of the intellectual comes in to give language to the struggle, create imaginaries, and of course to create counter imaginaries and counter language, because we are in a fight against a genocidal imperialist world order, and actually the matter of the fact is an imbalance of power, and this is where the role of the intellectual really kind of is heightened, because then you really have you really need to be using the imaginary. And I think I gave the example of Pip Day, who was moderating the conversation last night, quoted Amin from my film A Stone's Throw, who speaks of the why the imaginary is necessary, and then says, like a Palestinian child, 7 or 8 years old, throwing a stone at a tank. Materially, that does not make any sense. But I think an imaginary that is rooted in resistance understands that the stone is necessary, and that the spoon that the prisoners, the Palestinian political prisoners, use to dig a tunnel to liberate themselves from the most highly technological prison spaces in the world, the Gilboa prison, is necessary. The paraglide that Palestinians use to trespass Israel's iron wall to return to their towns and villages that they were displaced from in 1948 and 1967 on October 7th is necessary. So I think of all of these things as kind of moments where the intellect, the imaginary, becomes necessary for the struggle, and where we can understand as artists, as intellectuals, what is our role, and what is the measure of our relevance in the struggle? This is the measure. Like, this is how we align ourselves with the resistance. It's really by rooting ourselves in the material and also understanding how the imaginary can give it a line of flight. So the film Resistance Why, to speak to the context in which it was made, it was a film that was produced in 1972, post the 1967 Six-Day War, and the Israel's land theft of the entirety of historic Palestine, and I think at that moment this group of militant intellectuals were gathered by the 5th of June Society that produced this film, namely Soraya Antonios, they were brought together to produce an English language document in the form of this film to make language for the struggle in English, one. Two, to offer so many rebuttals to the Zionist propaganda machine, the Hasbara, that, you know, is globally spread through different means to kind of hide the genocidal intent of the Zionist project, and through layers of different liberal masks. And this is where kind of these liberal masks have used words as shields, but also images as walls that hide the massacre. And we can speak to these walls, right? Like, these walls take different forms. They take physical forms, they take verbal forms, they take image-based forms. And I think this is where my practice is also rooted. And then finally, it also gave language to the Palestinian struggle as a political project that has a historical materialist analysis of the struggle, speaks to its how it's intertwined with the region, with overthrowing reactionary regimes, and finally that it's an armed struggle. So I think this film in it of itself recognized that it had to create some kind of, or had to be some kind of, or took it upon itself to be in this kind of English-speaking document that presents the Palestinian liberation struggle within all of these frameworks that I just mentioned. And the final framework actually was also the role of solidarity within the region, in the world, but also with anti-Zionist Jewry. So it is those three kind of pillars that define the Palestinian liberation struggle: solidarity, a people's armed struggle, and kind of these counter imaginaries, counter words, counter or rebuttals to Israeli Zionist propaganda. And, you know, Ghassan Kanafani in the middle of the film says, you know, our war is a war of words because the enemy says they want peace. And, you know, imagine, we know after so many decades of usurping and weaponizing this word, that today the biggest chant of it all, no justice, no peace. Peace is justice. That you have to kind of redefine what we mean by peace, because the right has been able, and, you know, I'm thinking about liberals on the right as well. They just have a liberal mask, right? Like, they take something, a condition like peace, and they are able to abstract it into this liberal image of peace that is not rooted in material conditions, but becomes another image, another wall behind which they can hide genocide. The very first film I made, the short film called Your Father Was Born 100 Years Old and So Was the Nakba. And I made this film as a student, as part of my final thesis. And I remember at the time in class, my professor talking about the digital condition of embodiment and disembodiment, and me kind of intervening and saying, well, this is not the digital condition, this is the condition of displacement. And then realizing actually that the relationship between the material and the immaterial, between our life conditions and images, aesthetics, is not one of symbolism, but rather, or representation, but rather is kind of a very material relationship, in the sense that, yes, the displacement of people from their land, the separation of people from land, is very much, and the digitization of the world are very much materially connected, in the sense that the digital realm of Google Street View, for example, as a digital navigation of place, is another form of separating people from land and rendering land as real estate, as tourism, as commodity, right? And so what is the role of images in that? Of course, at the time, I didn't do all of this analysis right off the bat. I had to go through making the film to understand this. And let me tell you that story. So my professor was showing us Google Street View as an example of this embodiment and disembodiment. And I was like, wait, maybe my grandmother, who had already passed, can return to Haifa through Google Street View, where she was born and was never able to return. And, you know, very naively, I thought that this is the digital promise, you know, it will allow my grandmother to return. I'm going to make a film that is our family history and the landscape through which I will be filming, because I am unable to return to our land, to Haifa, to where my family is from, that I would be able to do that through Street View. Once I, you know, interviewed my dad and I recognized, or, you know, like we kind of pinpointed the geolocation where I can drop my avatar, I realized that actually the image is another border, another wall. You think you are trespassing the border through the digital, and you hit another wall, which is the image itself. How so? Well, one, it's through exactly that immersive photorealism that acts as a wall, because it has that, we read the photorealistic image, the photographic image, as real, as evidence, right? As a copy of the city. And so, you know, for Teta, who is now inside this film and returning and maybe perhaps escaping at the same time, when she encountered this place, her hometown, she was both able to see it and not be there either. And so, you know, you realize that these images, in fact, are, they are both kind of images that are owned by Teta. They are her hometown, the place that she comes from, and evidence that so-called Israel is a fait accompli, right? Look, this is the Israeli city of Haifa, right? And the image then, this Google image, becomes kind of a wall of the bodies, stories, of the place itself and its histories, by kind of becoming the image of that place, the postcard of Haifa, and kind of hides behind it my grandmother, her stories, all our grandmothers, all of our displaced refugees all around the world that come from Haifa. So, and the Palestinians that still live there, right? That's on one hand. On the other hand, also the navigation of Google Street View, kind of this click to command, moving from point A to point B, and with this click, this kind of position of the Google 360 camera down the streets, right, and taking these kind of surveys, image surveys of each geolocation. Just that way of navigating the space also aesthetically renders the person as a user, right, as a consumer of that place. And the context of using Google Street View for real estate, for tourism, so for visiting Israel, right? And the global north kind of digital gap. So all of this kind of going from the contextual down to the form and the content of this digital space, it's being weaponized as a digital extension of the occupation. That being said, these images are ours also. They are taken by Google, which we already know is part and parcel of the genocide in Gaza, and so and kind of has this dual use of weaponizing its images and its data for the occupation. I also realized that although these images are being weaponized as walls themselves, my role as a filmmaker is to really position myself in that struggle, at that level of how do I trespass the image as a wall, myself as a filmmaker. And this is where I think that the industrial process of making films does not work here. It really, our process needs to shift into one that makes relation, right? So in my mind, the industrial process of making films erases relations, hide relations, is another kind of material wall that you know, hides behind it how this image was made. And I think that our role as, you know, if we want to align ourselves with the resistance, if we want to consider ourselves militant filmmakers, then this is the crux of it. It's when we really struggle with the image itself as another weapon, and then also realize how we can trespass it ourselves. And you know, to come back to that short film, this took many forms. How do I make relation with the land, with my grandmother, with my father, with Haifa as a city, with letter Ha that has also been absented from the city, and so the Arabic language, making relation with that street that I land on where my father was born and Deta and her family were living. So it really kind of turned this process of making the film into a collective recollection of all of these things, starting exactly from that same image which has been weaponized against us. On the question of the archive, I have a couple of stories that are like through in and through the processes of making two different films, and I'll speak to them both. And then I can speak a little bit about Holy Land photography as one example of how photography is tied to the colonial project and tied to creating kind of postcard images of Palestine that create an imaginary that sets up Palestine as a land without a people. My first film, Your Father Was Born 100 Years Old and So Was the Nakba, I knew that I wanted to return to Haifa through Google Street View with my late grandmother, but I couldn't geolocate where she lived, where my father was born. And so I interviewed my dad and I was like, Baba, do you remember like which street you were born on? Where did you live? And he said, yes, I have a birth certificate. It's William Stanton Street. Of course, plugging that into the search function yielded no results. And because a lot of the place names, if not most of them, have been Zionized. And in my research, I realized that William Stanton is the British colonel also that occupied the city. And I, in my search of William Stanton, I found this image of a well, and in the on Wiki Commons, and which traces it back to the Israel's National Archive, which you know brings us to the fact that they've stolen all of these images and kind of captured them in their own archival institutions, and I found this image of a well with the caption that says, also a kind of a form of occupation of the caption itself, because it says Arabs collecting water in a well on William Stanton Street today, Shavat Zion. And this is how I realized that the Israeli name of the street is Shavat Zion, which helped me geolocate it on Google Street View. We see these layers of erasure in the archive, right? Access to the archive, access to the image, but also how it's captioned and how the political subjects, the you know, of the indigenous population that predates the Zionist colony are kind of deemed Arabs and not Palestinians. And so kind of to return to this idea of the war on words, but these are all footnotes to this story, because the real story is that I then plug in Shevat Zion, which, you know, serendipitously is Hebrew for return to Zion. I plug it into Google Street View and I kind of insert my avatar in there, and still we could not find my grandmother's home, my father's home. And so I decided that, okay, you know, Amin was maybe born in this well. And in that manner, I think at the very beginning of this first film that I made, I realized that the process really imposes its own writing of the film, its own aesthetics of the film. And this is how I allow the imaginary to be rooted in the material, in that, and in the limitations of the material, right? In that this impossibility of locating my father's home, I was kind of the archive or traces of the archive offered another possibility. That's my first story. My second story is in Making a Stone's Throw. I realized that British Petroleum produced a whole book, photography book, of celebrating the laborers that built the Kirkuk-Haifa pipeline specifically. And so you had a treasure of images that begins from Kirkuk and the process of building the pipeline, and then suddenly images disappear the moment you touch the border of Palestine. And suddenly we have no more images left except this one image that I use in the film. And, you know, to speak to images as walls and borders, also sometimes the archive is a wall, is a border, right? Literally at the border, at the colonial border, the archive reinforces that border by disappearing the mention, these laborers, because they divested, because they sabotaged, because they want to really disappear that history of that tail end of the pipeline being blown up. Because, you know, it had another bifurcation that goes to Tripoli in Lebanon. So they could still tell that story and re-divert the story to Tripoli rather than kind of speaking to that section of the pipeline that goes to Haifa. It's completely severed and disappeared by the archive. And so, you know, I end up turning this one image into a whole scene in the film, again, working with that limitation, rooting the film and the process of the film in the limit, in the material limitation, to come up with kind of the aesthetics of the film, that the temporality of it, the way that I move through that one image and I turn that one image into many images, because it is very much kind of a tableau, right, of power relations in the at the time, you know, the Palestinian that was the boss and probably the handler of the laborers, right, who was looking at his watch and kind of timing probably their labor. And, you know, you had the Zionist laborers, you had the British army and, you know, the different military vehicles, you had the oil barrels, the pipeline, and you had the aristocracy, like, and you had the cops, of course. So you have like those different kind of elements that make up the oil security infrastructure, that again points us to this infrastructure being both a military and a resource infrastructure that, you know, begins with the British and is handed down to the Zionist occupation.
And you stay a long time with the granular, very granular detail of the picture. So you're also thinking about the modes of production and the materiality of the material you are. Because, I mean, it becomes like this abstract picture, which is absolutely beautiful, and you stay with it.
Yeah, I think part of exploring the digital for me, although the original image is analog, obviously, but the what I'm working with is a digital copy of it. And so whenever I work with the digital, I tend to make it make that exploration manual. And so I, although I'm working with my computer, I'm actually working a lot with arrow keys and my mouse and my hands, and trying to really kind of extend the image and its materiality as a digital image through time, but also through cinematic space. So it becomes kind of, you really stretch the image and you stretch those pixels and you go down to the pixel, so that the image kind of is able to take up more space, take up more time, and kind of reveal itself both as form and content and structure and context in that process of like doing that manually rather than kind of in this smooth digital way. Yeah, so I mean, I'm also a teacher, and I think two things that I teach my students in film production. One is that the imaginary needs to be rooted in the material. So the immaterial, whatever, you know, aesthetics they has to be not like them sitting with themselves and imagining something and then, you know, taking whatever resources the university offers them to kind of execute that image in their head, but rather allow the process itself to emerge with its own aesthetics. But so that's one main, like, how do we shift the creative process into a process of relations? That's one main lesson that they learn. But I also start with another primary lesson, which is that images have always been weapons of war in different ways. One, for population control. We see this in how, you know, indigenous peoples have been photographed to essentialize them as a primitivity that belongs to the past, or to medicalize them as a racially inferior. So we're talking about different peoples from the African continent that were photographed, and these images used as medical evidence of their biological genetic inferiority that also justified in the Western imaginary their capture. Similarly to these histories, Palestine was also captured by the Western imaginary as the Holy Land, right? And, you know, Palestine is very much the Holy Land. Jesus is Palestinian. Moses is too, right? So, but, you know, there is the indigenous church, and then there is the churches of Europe sending their missionary photographers to Palestine to capture Palestine as a biblical imaginary in the Christianity that was in the Judeo-Christian rendering of Palestine as an extension of the European Judeo-Christian tradition. So I think this is where, like, you know, first of all, Palestine was emptied from its people, literally through emptying people from landscape photography. Or, you know, you would see the occasional, like, shepherd or Palestinian on a donkey, right? Because the donkey is also part of, like, the biblical imaginary and the shepherd is also part of the biblical imaginary of Palestine. We somehow know this and are legible in it because it's so dominant and hegemonic, right? Yeah, and, you know, place names are erased and their biblical names are given. And so you kind of systematically send waves of religious photographers to produce this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, right? To produce images for a self-fulfilling prophecy, in the sense that you already have a biblical imagination of Palestine, and then you take the camera and then you visualize that image. And that's why I say that industrial process of having an image in your head and then extracting resources to execute it is very much a colonial one. And in order to combat and counter the colonial imaginary, we need to change that process. And talk to people, talk to the land, situate ourselves, be in place, be clear and transparent and aware of, like, the process of making an image and the dangers of that, etc., etc., etc. So I also made a film called Canada Park, a short film that goes through Canada Park in occupied Palestine, a park that was transplanted by the Zionist occupation to greenwash the razing of three Palestinian villages in 1967, Yalu Amwas and Beit Nuba. So these are three villages that were razed to the ground A park was transplanted on top of these villages to hide the massacre. And this is part of a nationwide greenwashing machine that inspires itself also from Canadian national parks, which also have very much displaced indigenous tribes from their original villages in order to kind of create these cities of trees. I call them cities of trees because they become kind of these designed areas that use kind of natural preservation to, again, separate people from the land, right? So in the name, and they become another image, another green image, right? It becomes an aesthetic infrastructure that, hides what's the layers of history under it, buried, literally buried under it. And yeah, I mean, they plant pine trees, which also have kind of an aesthetic function because they Europeanize the landscape. It makes Palestine more familiar to its settlers, its European settlers. And in that, there's, you know, the trees, because they grow tall fast, they accelerate their function, their function of hiding the raised villages. And because they are so tall in this kind of semi-arid subclimate in that area specifically, they erase also the indigenous plants that no longer can catch any sun. And it kind of also erases the not just the indigenous people population, but also plants and fauna and flora. Just to follow with that, there is also a poetic justice here because there were a number of fires in Canada Park. And it's called Canada Park, by the way, because Canadian Zionists funded this park. And I made this film as soon as I landed in Canada, in this kind of contradiction of being a Palestinian refugee, but also settling on stolen land. I had to align myself somehow through Palestine with the Mohawks, the Ganyangaha Nation, which are the people of that part of where I live in Jahjage. So now I'm making a feature length film with one of the elders of the Ganyangaha Nation, specifically in Ganasatage, Katsitsakwas Ellen Gabriel, and so to expand on that. But at the time, once I landed, I didn't have those relationships, but I needed to do something to understand also the colonial infrastructures that extend from Canada to Israel. And that was one way to do that. And this is all to say that, it begins with imagining that Amwas, one of the villages that was razed, imagining it as Emmaus, which is mentioned in the Bible. And, you know, if you go to Canada Park today, we can't see any trace of Amwas, but we can see a trace of Emmaus. And this is a full circle of turning these landscapes, you know, to recreational parks, but also to biblical parks. And it all really comes back to how do we enact the occupation of Palestine as a series of images, as an image of it as a holy land, an image of it as a green desert, an image of it as, you know, a developed democracy that preserves nature as. And all of these ways in which the occupation executes its production. So on the question of visibility or opacity, explaining to and versus expressing or and expressing, I think this goes back to this understanding of the creative process as a circle of relations, as a collective recollection, rather than this industrial process of extracting resources, budgeting them, writing a script, and then you know, using these resources to execute that image, that script, which leads to this film as an art object, and then you distribute it as commodity. So this is kind of the industrial process. And the way I think about, you know, if we want to create films aligned with the resistance, we really need to change our modes of production and the way that we think about the creative process. And we really need to kind of be averse to turning our films into these art objects. So this is how I think we can kind of make sure that when we're making this film, we're making it for the people who are making it. So I'm making this film with my grandmother, with my late grandmother. I'm making it with my father. I'm making it with the city of Haifa or a stone's throw, for example. I'm making it with my father. I'm making it with this archival image and the laborers of the Kirkuk Haifa pipeline in 1936. I'm making it with a group of friends who lended their voices as a multivocality. I'm making it with Zirku Island as a place rather than just a man camp. I'm making it with the laborers who have left their voices as Google reviews on this island. I'm making it with the border villages in Lebanon, in southern Lebanon, looking at the Galilee, looking at occupied Palestine. I'm making it with the seaweed all along the Lebanese coast. And in my mind, the process of making the film has its audience embedded in it. And I think the only gaze that we have to be responsible for and responding to is that are those people, like our responsibility towards all the people that we're bringing into the film. Because the film then becomes its own site, right? Its own site of gathering and recollecting. And really, like, it imposes itself, or it must impose itself on the film, and it must change the film, because then you're bringing all of these voices and what they have said, their desires and challenges and ways of resisting are. And so you're bringing them in conversation with one another. And in that sense, the filmmaker kind of becomes an orchestrator more than a writer, or a writer as orchestrator, a writer as someone who convenes all of these things together in this site, which is the film. In that site, it becomes kind of, the process becomes responsible towards those people who are lending themselves to this film, rather than thinking that, oh, who's going to be watching my film? Let me respond to them. Because in my mind, then that sets up perhaps if I am kind of the 5th of June society in 1972, and I set my mission up as a collective that is producing English-speaking documents that represent the Palestinian struggle to the West, then okay, I already have, I'm setting my responsibility to the Palestinian struggle in the most radical, way of like analyzing it at the time with these group of intellectuals that were leading the struggle, and then setting myself up with that audience and that mission. But in my mind, for me and my practice, I think what I've been doing is talking to other Palestinians in exile, because part of that severance is also fragmentation. And I think our films then, what they do is they really rehearse our return to Palestine in different ways. Then kind of the process of that rehearsal in itself has the Palestinian people as its audience, rather than kind of thinking about this as a self-expression versus explanation to another. I think it's a third thing, which is, again, collectivizing our condition rather than understanding it as individual refugees, as Nabil Shaath and Sadiq Jalal Adam yesterday in Resistance Wise said, this is not a refugee matter, this is not a human rights framework, we are not individual refugees seeking compensation or a piece of land, we are a people who are struggling against an imperialist order that is seeking to erase us. I think this translates over to cinema and our filmmaking practices to ensure that, we are creating these films as a people as well. And of course, the occupation has one of the ways that it enacts its destruction is by severing our people in a million and one pieces, right? Like through this mass forced displacement, through the many ways that the land is severed by checkpoints and borders and walls. Just to say that there are different material conditions in exile, right? So there are people in the global north who are citizens of countries. There are Palestinians in refugee camps in Lebanon and Jordan and so and there are Palestinians inside Palestine in different material conditions as well, and the class element is key, and this is what the film yesterday also was explaining. And so to say that we are always anchored, that's why I say, I start with my family. I am very much grounded in the material conditions that I live in, so that I'm not attempting to represent. But at the same time, I understand that this condition is a collective condition. And this is where there's a tension, right? There's a tension and attention to the specificity, but also the universality or the kind of collective condition. Yeah. Regard Palestinien is a film screening collective based in Jahjage that has been organizing screenings of Palestinian cinema and discussions around Palestinian cinema for 20 years now. I've been a member for 9 years, and I think in 2023, after October 7th, our work just accelerated. We used to organize an annual festival of Palestinian film in the city, and starting 2023, we found ourselves needing to organize film screenings on a monthly, sometimes weekly basis, primarily as fundraisers. But then we realized also that there's something more crucial about these screenings that's happening. One is that the cinema offers a meeting space for people to physically be present with each other while watching one long document about Palestine. So it offered the physicality of the encounter rather than being individualized online. Two, it offered the temporality of the long form versus these like snippets that are, and this is where maybe we can speak to the visuality of genocide, because I think that Palestinians were in Gaza, were using cameras to bear witness to their own genocide. The camera becomes a form of, well, one, documenting resistance. So we see a lot of cameras and a lot of images coming out of resistance operations, but people who were being bombed and massacred in different ways were also using their phones to bear witness to it as a form of self-defense, also as a form of kind of the camera becomes a mediation device where they are able to perhaps look at what is happening to them in a different way, in a way that renders it perhaps more visible to them, to their brethren, to the world. That being said, unfortunately, these images are bound to social media platforms as their modes of distribution. And we know that the way that images circulate really affects how we receive them. One, as individuals on our phones, and that also kind of temporality that is fast enough to turn even the most violent of images to a form of consumption, and not to mention the economies of these platforms themselves. So I think that this is where we realize that we need to offer not just films that give us historical context of what is happening, of how Israel was founded on genocide, and you know, this genocide only accelerating in 2023, but also formally speaking how we receive these images, one in a physical space as a collective of people, and allowing then discussions to happen post-screening. So we wouldn't have any kind of like, we rarely had like people come in as experts. We really allowed people to just have a conversation that we moderated. So it turned the audience into a space, into kind of a circle of conversation and discussion, in which they can discuss the present in and through the film. And Finally, I think one very important element that was activated through our work these past 2 years is organizing around the Palestinian campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel. We faced censorship as soon as November 2023, where we had created this coalition of cultural organizations with Regard Palestinien and a series of screenings around Palestine. And as soon as we called the series From the River to the Sea, our partners started dropping like hot potatoes. So we realized that actually we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We really need to only partner with cultural organizations that have already signed on to PACB. One other thing that came out of censorship is also our realization that, you know, the moment that Cinéma du Parc in Montreal censored our screening, that we didn't want to go home and write a statement, that we actually came to the cinema still with our audience, and instead of going into the movie theater, we occupied the mezzanine of the cinema. Of course, the cinema called the cops on us. Of course, the cops were like, I mean, not of course, but, you know, at the time, the cops were like, we're not intervening in this. We're not going to arrest 150 people who are having a conversation in the mezzanine of a cinema. You know, in that conversation, we talked about Jocelyne Saab because we were showing her films. We talked about her films and we talked about PACB, and we actually apologized. Like, and at that moment, we wrote a statement to our audience saying, you know, we realize now that our collaboration with Cinéma du Parc was premature and did not come at the basis of PACB as the foundation and not the ceiling, right? Like as where we start, as the floor and not the ceiling. And so from there on, actually, we decided that we would partner with organizations that have signed on to PACB or have PACB in their horizon. And we, you know, we worked with another coalition of artists that emerged in the city that was organizing just around that. And we kind of worked in tandem between you know, screening films and ensuring that these cultural organizations are adhering to PACB. And then at another moment, we were censored by Concordia University that prevented us from screening Resistance Y, which is why we were invited here to Barcelona to show the film again and speak to that context at PEI. Yeah, I think this was another kind of key instance where we decided that we needed also our own, we needed to seize the means of production and have our own projector, our own battery, our own speaker. And, you know, when we got censored by Concordia University, we set up the projector and we screened the film on the wall of the university right outside, and we still watched the film, and we still organized our fundraiser, but on the street. And so this is all to say, like, I think what the genocide made more clear is that the image is as important as how it's made and how it's circulated and how it activates a certain politics, a certain coming together, and how it spills into organizing and onto the streets is what we should be thinking about when we, you know, we're trying to think about the role of Palestinian cinema and the politics of the struggle, especially in international solidarity. I mean, this is also where we need to ensure, as Palestinian film collectives, as Palestine film festivals around the world, that we are not just showing our films within the walls of cultural institutions, because it's necessary that we are also organizing around you know, collectivizing this viewership beyond people who are, you know, interested in cinema. And, you know, with Regard Palestinien, what we've been doing is we've been taking our programs into spaces that have been organizing for Palestine. So into union spaces, into university student activist spaces, into parks, on the street, as projection actions, to exactly make sure that people are able to access these films beyond these modes of distribution that render these films only visible through festivals and through events and such. As Salma Dabbagh was saying yesterday, the archive of the Palestine Research Institute, including the film Resistance Y, was stolen by the Zionists in their invasion of Beirut in 1982. So this archive is completely disappeared for many years, and then it re-emerges in the Israeli National Archive as, you know, stolen images, as a stolen archive. Namely, Resistance Y re-emerged in Soraya Antonius's personal archive, actually, and was restored by Nadi Likul Nas, which means a cine club for everyone, which is a film collective based in Beirut, which Christian Ghazi has entrusted with his films to restore and distribute. And again, here we see an example of a film collective that understands how to align itself with the resistance, how to align itself as a militant distribution collective, rather than kind of isolating these very important films, very important to the struggle, to film festivals and like that kind of modes of distribution. It's really been functioning as a cine club for everyone, making these films accessible all around Lebanon and the Arab world, and distributing to comrades and other collectives and non-cultural spaces, spaces with people and people who care about Palestine, rather than, falling into that trap of isolating the films within festivals, because it's another kind of theft, right? It's almost kind of an extension of stealing them and stealing those materials and imprisoning them within the Israeli National Archive. There's another form of imprisonment that's happening when, you know, you capture these films as films that only get distributed through festivals and commercial distribution companies, that renders them inaccessible to people who are actually fighting the fight on the ground. Yeah, the production and distribution of images of Israeli soldiers blowing up lives and places, and smiling to the camera, I think is another organized psychological operation by Israeli Hasbara, one, to regain kind of the invisibility of the Israeli occupation army, which has been broken by the innovative and radical and revolutionary imaginary of the resistance, right? That one of the early founding fathers, quote unquote, of Zionism, Jabotinsky, talks about the Zionist Iron Wall. He says is necessary to subjugate and separate the Zionist entity from the indigenous population in Palestine. And defines the Zionist political project as a settler colonial one, and that necessitates an iron wall that imprisons and isolates the indigenous population and controls that population. The resistance was able to break that almighty iron wall, and Israelis needed to reestablish some form of psychological and imaginary image-based deterrence by producing these hyper-violent images of their soldiers having so much power, like, pressing a button and exploding a whole universe. That's the function of that image, but it's still an image. One, two, it really reveals that desperate weakness in my mind. And two, it incriminates them over and over and over and over again. I think what's key now is for us to be able to transform these images into an actual politics, right? So we have the images as evidence. It's been already used in the ICJ case against case of genocide against Israel. But the political will is still lacking, right? In my mind, there's this kind of normalization of violence by the excess of violent images online. And that's why I think we also need to make sure that, we are bearing witness with the people of Gaza and what they are sending out as messages to the world, that we are not just consuming violent images, that we are making sure that these images coupled with other images like films, like in physical space, and everything I've talked about, like what Ragar Palestinian is doing. I don't have much to kind of reflect critically on these images themselves, because I think that, these are images of weakness and desperation. Genocidal depravity. And I think our role is to stay focused with the images that are being produced by the resistance, images that are produced by people in Gaza, in Lebanon, in all over Palestine. People on the ground, people resisting in the infinite ways that they are resisting in, And, you know, as people living in exile, to organize together and make sure that Palestinian cinema and Palestinian images at large are being distributed in ways that ensures that they lead to political action rather than being consumed as images of war, rather than kind of falling into this consumption of these images, either as, you know, Palestinians as victims or Palestine as this kind of radical left rhetoric that doesn't actually translate to material solidarity. So making sure that these images are circulating in spaces that adhere to PACB, in spaces with comrades that are actually organizing on the street. Staying true to why Gazans were bearing witness and sending images to the world, because they want to be, they want to be seen to resisting, and they want to be seen. They wanted to kind of show the crime, right? So, and I think it's key how we receive those images, and this is where our role is so crucial.